Hey, not Air Marshal John. You want to get back in that restroom and not rest?
No. I have to get back to my seat.
Yeah, you got to get back on my seat. You get it?
No, I think, yeah, I definitely got it.
Uh-oh. What's that?
I got to get back to my seat. Could you just move your leg, please? I got to go.
Uh-oh. Somebody found a souvenir. You feel that steam heat coming? That's from my undercarriage.
Okay.
That should go up and higher.
Well, pour yourself a glass, sit for a spill. It's time to have some fun. Let's do a little thinking, some picking and a drinking. Well, this is what we're drinking with Dan Dunn.
Thank you, Kalai King, the man who wrote and performed the theme to this show. He's a good man, too. Heard that clip of Bridesmaids at the top of this program. Played that for a reason, because my guest on the show today is the gentleman who directed Bridesmaids, Mr. Paul Feig, who also happens to be the founder of Ardingstall's brilliant London Dry Gin, which is what we're drinking on What We're Drinking Today. So coming up in just a few minutes, a chat with Paul Feig. Very exciting stuff. He is one of Hollywood's most in-demand directors, or at least he was prior to COVID. Now, who the hell knows what's going on? So this, I'm taping this on July 1st. This will be the last show we do before the 4th of July holiday. I will be honest with you, the 4th of July is probably my least favorite holiday of the year. Not even probably, it's definitely my least favorite holiday of the year. This weekend will mark the 10th anniversary of the death of my younger brother, Brian. On the 4th of July in 2010, we hung out all day in Marina Del Rey. We were having fun, partying, a big group of people. And then later that night, Brian and a friend went down to the Venice Pier in Venice Beach with the idea of jumping off the pier and swimming in for fun, shits and giggles. And Brian did it. He jumped, and he got caught in a riptide, and he drowned. The actual date of his death is July 5th. He did it about 2 o'clock in the morning. I guess if we're going to get technical, on his death certificate, it says July 11th, because that's the day they found his body out in the Pacific Ocean. So a couple of years later, I needed to deal with Brian's death, and I got in my car, and I drove around the United States for almost 4 months, visiting wineries everywhere from California to Montana to Maine, down to South Carolina, and all across the southern border of the United States. And eventually that trip led to the publication of my book, American Wino, A Tale of Reds, Whites, and One Man's Blues, which ostensibly is about my quest to become the leading expert on American wine, but really it's about a road trip I took with a jar of my brother's ashes. And make no mistake, Brian was with me all along that journey. And I chronicle that in the book. And so to commemorate this 10-year anniversary, I really like to celebrate Brian's birthday, but I also want to acknowledge that it was 10 years ago this weekend that everything changed in my life and my family's life and the people that were close to Brian outside the family. And so here's a little story that appears in the book. I didn't want to get too heavy. So this involves a rainstorm and my brother giving me shit and the two of us acting like we did when he was alive. New York City to Philly is only a 2-hour drive. Compared to the distances I'd been averaging on this trip, it barely qualified as going anywhere. To make up for this unconscionable lack of hardship, As I crossed the Verrazano Bridge into Staten Island, the cranky-looking sky opened up and unleashed a rainstorm of biblical proportions. By the time I got to Jersey, it was so bad, I could barely see 10 feet in front of me. Philly and New York City have been rivals ever since Ben Franklin called Manhattan's whorehouses, quote, substandard, and quote, unfit for even the vilest strumpet. But as far as I can tell, the bad blood is primarily fueled by the fact that the two cities are shockingly similar to each other in temperament, which is to say, both are populated by a high percentage of balls-out maniacs. Case in point, the New Jersey Turnpike between New York City and Philadelphia, where this goddamn monsoon had cut the speed on the packed highway from 80 to 70. LA people say they don't need weather because they have traffic. But the risk of bursting my friends' bubbles, it's worth noting that, and stick with me on this, other places have traffic also. And get this, they have weather too. Also seasons, wrinkles, anger, and shame. This is not to say that I remain unwarped by LA's peculiar delusions. My first instinct when the storm started was to compliment the special effects guy. I swear, at one point on the drive, I thought about taking a break and stepping out of my car where I'd find a green screen and a second AD handing me a chai tea latte and a hot towel. This was no CG guy's weather porn, though. The storm was down low and furious. The 11 a.m. darkness broken by lightning strikes, followed instantly by SUV-rattling thunderclaps. It was probably an inch of running water on the highway. Glances at my fellow road surfers revealed a white-knuckled crew, eyes wide, unnerved, and kicking themselves for not springing the extra $50 for brand-name rain-tread tires. There was a palpable sense that something was about to go horribly, horribly wrong out here, the only question being, how many of us were going to go down? That, of course, is the usual feeling you get on the ribbon that connects our nation's two most pugnacious cities, but this storm wasn't doing anything to calm people's nerves. It felt supernatural, like at any second, Thor might get jealous of Zeus's light show and slam down his hammer, splitting the Jersey Turnpike wide open. The thought of being swallowed up, interred forever like a turncoat mobster in the bowels of the Garden State was almost comforting. It sure would beat driving in this shit anyway. None of this was helped, of course, by the acute wine-induced hangover I was enjoying. In spite of being cold outside, the increased levels of poison in my system were causing me to sweat profusely. My central nervous system was operating with the approximate efficiency of the 113th Congress, only my organs were being a little nastier to one another. I'd been this banged up behind the wheel on the trip before, Wyoming, for instance, but out there it was all blue skies and open spaces. If you can stay awake and avoid suicidal wildlife, you'll be okay. Here, though, I was surrounded by minivans piloted by panicky soccer moms, windowless beat-to-shit construction vans, and SUVs that plainly gave no fucks about you or your silly ideas about what constitutes a lane. As these thoughts stumbled around my wounded brain, somewhere far away an alarm began to sound. There had been an audible rise in the engine RPM. The hell would cause that when I'm moving at a steady and slowly, like a sunrise that never seems to arrive and then suddenly blinds you, I knew. Hydroplaning. It explained a lot. Not just the noise, but the gentle rotational movement my SUV had begun to take on. The world had downshifted into ultra-slow motion with infinite space inside of every moment, allowing me to savor every facet of the experience. I told myself to stay calm, but it didn't work. So I screamed at myself to stay calm. That always works. Then I screamed back at myself to stop goddamn yelling unless I wanted to die right now in New Jersey. That shut me up pretty good. No one wants to die in New Jersey. Even those Jersey Shore knuckleheads. They all want to die in Miami. The hair on my body was standing on end like a million teenage boners. I opened my mouth because somehow it felt like I should say something. But either I didn't have anything to say or I couldn't hear myself over the rain. Or the radio, which was blasting Bohemian Rhapsody. Who's going to take care of my dog? I'm going to miss you, Buna. Then I remembered the things on my pre-trip to-do list I had biffed. One stood out. Make a will. You can do it all online now. Only takes a few minutes. I would have given Buna to Brian. I'm dead, asshole, Brian noted from his cup holder. Besides, I'm already taking care of your last dog. Piglet says hi, by the way. Oh, shit, that's right. Brian's dead. Okay, my brother John should get Boone, and Brian could get my record collection. Still dead, Brian cackled. Shit, okay. Then Elizabeth, my ex-girlfriend, should get the records. We might not be together anymore, but at least she knew how to take care of them. You want to give your record collection to your ex, Brian sputtered, incredulous? Sure, I said. It's not like I'm going to be listening to them. Yeah, but you want her to die in a fire, don't you? Can you just cut me the tiniest speck of slack, Brian? I have a couple small things on my mind at the moment, not the least of which is the fact that I'm sliding, helplessly, into the lane next to mine. Man, people make some funny faces when you lose control of your car next to them in a thunderstorm. I see you shouting, sir, but unfortunately there's not much I can do about this. My steering wheel is no longer a steering wheel, you see? Just a giant, round hunk of metal and plastic that's about to explode an airbag all over me. Want to talk to someone in charge? Talk to this SUV. But you can take it from me, no matter how much you shout at him, he doesn't answer. He's a stoic motherfucker. Being dead's pretty sweet, Brian interjected helpfully. You'll like it. Why? Because you get to come back and annoy the shit out of family members while they're at their worst? That is one of the perks, yeah, he replied. Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me. Little on the nose, don't you think? Brian said. I don't control the playlist, Dick. It's the radio, I shot back. I was now fully in the next lane over with no sign of stopping, my lazy fishtail starting to swing back the other way. Sure, but you're the one listening to classic Rewind all day. This wouldn't have happened if you'd been listening to The Message. Huh? The fucking Christian pop channel? You're seriously saying that my choice of radio stations is why I'm about to get into a massive traffic pileup on the Jersey Turnpike? Nah, dude, Brian said. I just like the way your face gets all scrunched up when I say something stupid. Fuck you, Brian. Seriously, fuck you. I have to deal with this. Deal with what? He said. It's out of your hands. Just sit back and enjoy the ride. How often do you get to slide across two lanes of traffic at 70 miles an hour? That attitude is exactly what pisses me off about you dead fuckers. You don't have to deal with anything. Well, guess what? Back here, we're all picking up your shit for you and trying to get over your stupid ass. But that's what's so awesome about being dead, Brian replied. No responsibilities, no expectations, no bills. Oh, and no spam. We don't even have phones. It's awesome. Oh, shit. When I die, they're going to clean out my bedroom. That means they're going to find the Viagra and the butt plugs. Those aren't even mine. What was that Bill Hicks bit about his parents finding his porn after he died? At least the VCR era is over, so I don't have a bunch of giant tapes hanging around. You also don't have a fucking bedroom, Brian reminded me. Okay, notch another point for the smartass. He was right. I'd moved to nowhere. The closest thing I had to a bedroom now was my SUV. Okay, so they'd find fewer butt plugs and more dashboard hula girls. Still mortifying. And now I was clearing the second lane. How's the shoulder looking? Nice and wide, actually, but then it was Guardrail City. America's second shittiest town. Right behind Skokie, Illinois. Cheer up, man, Brian said. Just think of the look on Elizabeth's face when she hears you're gone. I pictured my ex-girlfriend Elizabeth at my funeral. Her new boyfriend Jack with his arm around her as she wept behind her sunglasses. Classic L.A. sun streaming down on the... Wait, fuck. I was going to die in Jersey. They'd probably have the funeral in Philly where the family is. Doubtful she'd come east to bury her ex-boyfriend. Shame. She looked amazing in black. Don't worry, man. You can ghost her, Brian offered. You mean haunt her? Nah, man. Ghost her. Hang around her house and look longingly at her face and do pottery and shit, like Kurt Russell. That was Patrick Swayze. Kurt doesn't do that sentimental shit. Yeah, but you do, Brian said. I do what? I asked. That sentimental shit. Now, if you'd asked me 3 months prior what my ideal afterlife was... It might have resembled that 1990 cinematic shitster piece, Ghost. The wistful looks, the flowy shirts, the pottery, unchained melody. But now, in the super slow-mo realm of pure reaction and total consciousness, it hit me. I didn't want that stupid, sad sack, can't move on crap. Not for Elizabeth. Hell, not for anyone. I had my life. She had hers. She might have been a dummy for breaking up with me, but that was on her, not me. Or maybe she was smart for breaking up with me. Either way, I was done feeling shitty about her. Good. You can finally start feeling shitty about me, Brian mumbled. You dick. All this talk of shit got me thinking of whether I'd shit myself in the wreckage. Didn't people do that? Was I even wearing underwear today? Just my luck. They're going to pull me out of this pileup with a giant stain down my back, and some asshole will pull out his phone and film it, because that's what people do now, and then my final shitty act on this planet would end up going viral, and that would be what everyone remembered about me. Not the writing, not the dogs I rescued, not the radio show, or the time I was on Conan, not the women I almost married or the kids I never had, not the charity work I always talked about wanting to do. Oh, Jesus Christ. Let me get a fucking box of tissues, Brian said. You know what, Brian? I didn't make fun of you while you were dying. Oh, I know, he said. You didn't do anything. Except sleep, of course. You're good at that. What's that supposed to mean? You don't think I'd still be alive if you'd come out with me that night? I didn't want to encourage you, I said. You were drunk. You should have protected me, he said. I was drunk. Is this really the time for us to discuss this, Brian? I'm trying to die here. Not hard enough, apparently, he said. I must have instinctively eased off the accelerator, hit a dry patch, or appeased Thor or Patrick Swayze, because just as my SUV was entering the outskirts of Guardrail City, the wheels found traction on the asphalt again. And what do you know? The car was facing approximately the same direction as he was traveling. Life snapped back to normal speed again, and Brian shut up. I had threaded a needle through the gaps between four or five different cars to the far right lane, and I could feel the drivers of each of those cars screaming as a wall of adrenaline slammed into my body, making all my muscles contract at once, my thighs aching with flight hormone. Which is why, on the shortest trip of my entire journey, I stopped halfway for a breather. Breathing seemed like a pretty awesome, if undeserved, thing to be doing right now. What do we have here? Ah, yes, Mack Weldon. Oh, how I love me some Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon is a premium men's essential brand that believes in smart design and premium fabrics. You probably heard about their industry-leading underwear. Hell, I'm wearing a pair right now. They're so much more than just an underwear company. They really are one-stop shop for men's basics of all kinds. From socks, to shirts, to hoodies, to their new adjustable Storm Chaser rain jacket, Mack Weldon's wares really are the longest-lasting, highest-quality items on the market. They believe in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. I went to MackWeldon.com recently, ordered a whole bunch of stuff. Took me 10 minutes, and now I'm rocking a killer new basics wardrobe. I got some 18-hour Jersey Crew neck undershirts, couple of pairs of Ace sweatshorts, and no-show socks. And Mack Weldon really does value its loyal customers. That's why they've created the Weldon Blue Loyalty Program. Here's how it works. Create an account. It's totally free. Level 1, place an order for any amount and never pay for shipping again. Level 2, once you purchase $200 worth of products from Mack Weldon, not only will you continue to receive free shipping, but you will also start saving 20% on every order you make for the next year. Oh, and Level 2 also grants you access to new products before they're released to anyone else, as well as free gifts added to future orders. And now, Mack Weldon has a special offer for you, What We're Drinking listeners. For 20% off a first order, your first order, visit MackWeldon.com and enter the promo code DRINKING. They want you to be comfortable, so if you don't like your first pair of underwear, you can keep it, and they'll still refund you, no questions asked. Mack Weldon's mission is simple, to make sure all your basics and beyond are smartly designed and that shopping for them is easy and convenient. And I personally promise you this, Mack Weldon is better than whatever you're wearing right now. With me now, a man I admire greatly, created one of my favorite TV series, Freaks and Geeks, as well as directing a number of fine motion pictures, including Bridesmaids. Who doesn't love Bridesmaids? If you don't love Bridesmaids, you turn the show off right now. I don't want you here. The Heat, the all-female reboot of Ghostbusters back in 2016. He did a simple favor last Christmas. He's also directed tons of other great television, from The Office, Arrested Development, Weeds, Nurse Jackie. He's gotten two Primetime Emmy Awards for writing on Freaks and Geeks and for producing and directing The Office. But for the purposes of this show, we're having him on because he is the founder of Ardenstahl's brilliant London Dry Gin, a brand, Ardenstahl, which is named after it's his mother's maiden name, actually. So let's bring him on right now to talk about that, Mr. Paul Feig. Paul, how are you?
Hello, Dan. How are you?
Oh, man, it's good to have you here. As I mentioned, I'm a big admirer of your work, and we're very happy you took some time to talk to us. I want to immediately raise a toast to you. I know you like the martini, but yes. I went with the Tom Collins, okay?
You know what? That is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with the Tom Collins.
100% compostable straw here that I'm using as well. Very important. The Tom Collins was actually the first cocktail I ever had in my life. I was a teenager in Philadelphia. I didn't know anything about drinking. I had snuck into a bar with some friends of mine. We were all like 16 or something. And when the bartender came up to ask us what we wanted, now we were already in, but there was still this fear that we were going to be found out. And so I didn't want to just order a beer or something because I thought I need to act sophisticated.
There you go. So you fit in.
And he said, what do you want? And the only drink that I could think of, the only name, I think I'd heard my dad say it was Tom Collins. And I ordered that. And then the guy, my buddy next to me, he goes, what do you want? He goes, Tom Collins. We all just Tom Collins down the line. So everybody knows that the Tom Collins is actually gin, lemon, simple syrup, and some soda. It's classic and timeless. And
it's a great gateway drink, you know?
And it tastes damn good with your gin in it. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the origin of this gin. You were a martini fan, and from what I've read, everything your quest to find the perfect martini led you to actually create this brand.
Yeah, you know, I like all of us, I think as a kid, I had a bad experience with gin. About 8 years old, and we were down in the basement of a friend's house, and the dad had a bar, and my parents didn't drink, so it's like, ooh, so we snuck in there, and of course opened a bottle of Beefeater and took a slug and went like, ah, it tastes like pine trees, ah, it tastes like cleanser, you know, and freaked out. And so I had this image that I think a lot of people have now of gin, because a lot of people go like, oh, I don't like gin, because we had that weird experience. And so, you know, flash forward to later on in my life, and, you know, I love cocktails, I just love the whole world of cocktails. I love the adult kind of setting of it all. As a kid, I just couldn't wait to be an adult and have cocktails and dress in tuxedos and go to, you know, fancy places. And so, you know, started drinking cocktails, but still had this weird prejudice against gin. But to me, there's nothing more beautiful than a martini. Martini glass, just the shape of it. It looks great on screen and movies, you know, like in a bar.
Well, I was going to say that as somebody who works in the film business, there's such a rich history. I mean, you can go back to Casablanca. What did he say? Of all the gin joints in the world, you know, it was the most popular clear spirit in America prior to Prohibition.
Oh, totally. You know, because I'm a big William Powell fan and just watching, not even in movies, all the other ones, they're all just constantly drinking these you know, gin martinis or gin cocktails. And so I just kind of went, I want to become a martini guy, but there's something about like a vodka martini didn't seem right. And then I started reading about martinis and just kept reading like a real martini is a gin martini. And so just one day went like, I'm going to teach myself to like gin. And that was when I kind of, this was number of years ago when you still was kind of, you know, all the regular ones were all you had the option for. And so kind of made myself get used to that super junipery thing, which I didn't mind, and kind of grew to love it. But at the same time, I was always like, oh, there's gotta be a better way to do this. And then it was when I had my first Hendrix, like right when it had first come out, like a friend of mine brought it back from the UK. I was like, you gotta try this. Then I was like, oh my gosh, so this is kind of what gin could be too. And so then started realizing, oh my God, there's so many different tastes of gin and so many different ways to do it. And, you know, and then started, my wife and I travel the world, and when I make my movies, I'm traveling. And just anywhere, any country we would go, I would try all their gins and just saw so many differences, but then started seeing the things that I wished a gin would be. And basically, just said for years, if I could ever have my own gin, I know exactly what I want it to taste like. And it basically is what you've got in your glass right there.
Well, I just poured myself. So as I mentioned, I had the Tom Collins, but I also want to try this neat. So as I tell you guys all the time, the first thing you want to do, you don't want to ram your nose into this glass because you're going to burn your nose out. You want to get your nose maybe an inch or two above the glass, keep your mouth open, breathe the whole thing in, right? And to me, right off the bat, this is a very floral gin. It's got a there's almost a, I mean, the floral notes are the first thing that are hitting me, but then I'm getting, there's even like a little bit of a spicy peppery note to the, on the nose. I'm getting a little bit there.
Yeah.
Little bite. And then, and then with the flavor, and I like to take a little bit to coat my palate, and then I take a bigger sip after that. Mm. And the first thing that jumps out at me about this, and we were talking about, is this is a delicate gin. And I don't mean flimsy. I mean, it's a delicate gin. Mm-hmm. Juniper, as Paul mentioned, is the most notable of botanicals used to make gin. It is, it's in pretty much every gin. But this one is not what I would call a juniper forward gin. I think it's very subtle here. And I'm actually getting more of sort of the citrus. I got a little lemon there going on. I mean, even probably more prominent than the juniper in this one is I'm getting the citrus.
Yeah, but I like that you picked up on the pepper. There's definitely pepper in there and things like orris root and that kind of thing. And yeah, what is interesting to me about that gin too is you do get hit with that floral right up front through the nose. And when we were formulating it, I was like, wow, that's interesting. I don't know if that was what I was looking to do. But then when I, then, you know, and this is, you know, went through rounds and rounds and rounds of formulas and all this. But when I got down to the final one, it was so deceptive because you hit that. And then when it hits your palate, like you say, you get the citrus, you get some of the spice. And that's what I think I love about it, because it's very, I wanted it to be very friendly. I wanted to make what I call a gateway gin, which is for people who go like, oh, I don't like gin. You go like, okay, good. Try this. You know, I want to be the one you graduate from vodka from, because I, you know, look, I love vodka. Vodka is a great thing, but vodka feels a lot of times like sort of the amateur spirit, you know, because it doesn't have any taste, obviously. And, you know, to go from that to like a Junipero or a, you know, or a Berry Brothers number 3, where you're like, wham, and you get socked in the face with all that juniper. I wanted to make sure I could kind of transition you in. And so that's exactly what we did with this.
This is what's called a London dry gin. Okay. And so, you know, despite the name, London dry gins can be made anywhere in the world. And in fact, Paul, you're working, and make sure I get this right, is it Minas Craft Brewery and Distillery?
Minas.
And they're from Calgary, but they also have a distillery in Wisconsin, correct?
Yeah, in Monroe, Wisconsin. Yeah, so all the distilling tends to go on in Monroe. But they're also like the 7th biggest brewer and distributor of beer in North America, too. So they're an amazing company. But what I love is they're family owned. It's a brother and sister, Manjeet and Ravinder Minhas, who started this company when they were like teenagers, basically, to do cheap beer. And it just blossomed into this whole thing. They were making a lot of well spirits. They also make a lot of alcohol for like Trader Joe's, you know, so a lot of there, you'll see their rum and stuff that comes from Minhas. But what they didn't have was like what they consider to be a premium spirit. And so when I, you know, when my people contacted them, because I was looking for years for somebody to do this, and you know, my agency and all that are really great at getting stuff done. But at the same time, they would say, look, you're not like a famous musician. You're not like a famous actor or anything. It's going to be really hard to get somebody to want to do, you know, to do a liquor with you. I was like, just please keep trying. Just please look. And so after a number of years, they came across Minhas, who just at that moment decided they were wanted to branch into possibly trying a premium spirit. And then they did research on what I do and just like sort of the lifestyle that I represent of, you know, how I like to present a very fun adult lifestyle where it's, you know, I feel like so many men of my age, you know, I'm 57 years old, men of my generation have been fighting so hard to try to be teenagers, weirdly, and we've lost this whole. Yes, there you go.
This guy right here.
Yeah. No.
What are you talking about, drink, Paul?
So that right there. But I want to bring back that sort of fun sophistication that a William Powell did. You know, you watch those movies, you go like, oh my god, that's so fun. I want to drink with them. I want to look at they're having such a fun attitude towards it, and everything's beautiful, and the glassware is cool. And
so it's also the lifestyle. We're not just talking about and gin certainly evokes a certain, you know, it's different than, say, tequila. When I think tequila, I think of, you know, a party at Senior Frogs. We're doing, you know, gin has a certain level of sophistication that maybe some other spirits don't. I just want to finish up on that thought with it, so everybody understands about London dry gin. Back in the early 1800s, 1831, they a still was invented called the coffee still. And what that what prior to that, the pot still was the most popular still used for distillation. The coffee still was capable of continuous distillation by reheating the liquid, okay, instead of doing it in batches. So you could produce higher ABV spirits than pot stills. And there's what a coffee still looks like. There's two columns, and they're separated by heated plates. And these plates allow upward passage of steam and vapor, and that becomes the spirit. Okay, there's some geeky stuff away, but what basically what it means is this. Prior to the invention of the coffee still, gin was flavored with all sorts of stuff to try and cover up a lot of the unpleasant notes that were in there. And what the coffee still enabled was a production of a pure spirit they could sell unsweetened, or what they called dry. So there you have it. That's where London dry gin comes from. It, again, can be made anywhere, including Wisconsin, where Paul's.
And to pile on to that, you know, the FDA is very, very finicky and specific about what you can call a London dry. And they really vet it heavily. There's things you can't have in it, things you can't, you know, you can't have, I don't know, there are various kind of peels and tastes you just can't have in it. So they really guard it. So, you know, it was a real eye opener for me what Ravinder Minhas had to go through just to get our label approved. I mean, they have to approve every single word on a label. And so, you know, but I really wanted this to be a London dry, and fortunately we got that. But it was quite a nail biter for a while.
When you went into this, Paul, did you have a very specific, I know you mentioned you wanted to kind of dial back the juniper a little bit, but did you have a very specific flavor profile in mind going in, or did it evolve as you got into the R&D process a little bit?
No, I knew exactly what I wanted, which was a very smooth gin that wasn't too juniper forward and had kind of a roundness to it. And so when my first meeting with them, I basically gave examples of gins that I like that are in that world, but are missing certain things or don't hit the mark, but have things that I like, qualities I like. So that was our first kind of R&D thing. Then they went away and did 8 different batches or bottles, you know, whatever, batches of gin with very, you know, within that world I had talked about, but with very big differences between.
There were distinct differences between this, but it was under one umbrella, but with each one had a little nuance.
Like they didn't make any that were super junipery. They didn't make any that were, you know, whatever. Sure. So, or sweet or anything like that, like an Old Tom or anything like that. So then when we got together, you know, we had this big tasting. You know, I went to Monroe, Wisconsin, and tasted it, and it was like, hey, not that one at all. Oh wait, there's something in here I like. No, there's something in here I like. It could be 10% of this and 20% of that, and it was very, very, you know, very specific. And then what they did is they took that information, went away, did another 8 batches that were much closer to what I wanted, but with all these variations of how much alcohol content was in it, and how much, you know, this citrus peel they put in, or how much pepper they put in this one, how much lemongrass they put in this one. And we did the same thing again, that we did this taste and compare with these 8 things, and got down to very like a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of this. And so we did that three times. And they're so good. They have a really great team that are, you know, they're scientists that you know, distill these things, that they got really close. So it was that last round of 8. They were really micro differences between them all. But the thing I never realized is how much of a difference 2% alcohol difference makes for the taste of a gin. Because when I got down to the one that I liked the most, there was one I was like, oh, I like it, but there's just too much flavor in it. And then there's another, I go like, wow, this one's just too sharp. And then, and so one was a 40% and one was a 44%. And so I was like, it's not right. It's not right. And then Ravinder's like, wait, I know what to do. I'm telling you, he said, I got to bring it to 42%. I said, like, that's so incremental. It won't make a difference. He said, like, trust me, it will make a difference. He brought it and it's what you're drinking now. And it just blew my mind what a huge difference that 2% of alcohol made.
So it's an interesting thing when you put that in the context of making films, right? You mm-hmm. see things, I'm sure, that most people don't. Like, if we cut here, if we cut 1 second too late,
yeah,
ruins it. You know, little subtle things. D- Do you find that that's carrying over now, I guess, into this world? Because I bring it up because I'm looking behind you there. You've got an original Ocean's 11 frame thing. So I know Steven Soderbergh, and I've had Soderbergh on the show. He did the Ocean's 11 remake years ago, and Steven's got his own spirit brand. I don't know any other directors. It's you and him, I think. He's got the Singani, which is a brandy, basically. Well, Singani's actually the category, but he talked about that, about the precision that he applies to his film career.
Yeah.
How, in some ways, he finds the spirits world even more precise, even more challenging. You have to get it right or it's all done. Yeah.
Well, it's like baking, you know, if you get one thing just a hair off, the whole, you know, cake falls in or the bread falls apart. And yeah, it's a really good analogy because we're so focused on micro details that people don't notice, but you notice that they're wrong. And, but the scary thing about formulating a gin or a spirit is that, it's not easier, but somehow when you look at something visually, something is kind of easier to kind of go like, that's right or that's wrong. But something that's like palette based is very specific. And the biggest fear for me was like not wanting to just formulate something that I like that nobody else would like, you know? And so that's why there's a lot of like, what do you guys think? What do you guys think? Like giving it to people. But also the other thing was, look, here's Dan. I've never been more drunk than the day I had to finalize my recipe for this in the conference room of my office. Because here's these 8 bottles, all micro kind of, you know, variations. So I'm just taking sips, but it's like, okay, well, this one against playing those 8 bottles against each other just the whole time. My wife's like, you couldn't have spit it out. It's like, there's nothing to spit out. Like you're just taking a micro thing, but it's, you know, it's strong alcohol. So once I kind of got locked in on what I thought was right, then it's like, okay, let's got to make a martini. We got to make a Negroni. We got to make a dirty martini. We got to make it, you know, I want to make sure that it's good at room temperature. I want to make sure that it's good on ice. And so I was so nervous because it was like, whatever I sign off on, I'm going to be stuck with, and I'm either going to be judged really harshly by, you know, very finicky liquor experts, as we know, anybody who's an expert in anything is that way. And it was just really nerve-wracking, but I'm really, really pleased at the fact that it came out so well. And our first outing, you know, the World Spirits Wholesalers Association, we won Best in Show and Double Gold, and we just got a 94 from Taster's Panel magazine. So I feel good that I made my choice.
I should bring up, you know, talking about tasting, you won Double Gold and Best Gin at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition, right?
No, it was in Florida. It's the,
it was WSWA.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. And which I used to host a bunch of events down there. They switch them every year. It's Orlando one year, Vegas the next year, back and forth. But it's a big deal to do that, and that's a lot of industry people. And you mentioned, you know, the withering criticism that can come. Oh. And you've even got a bigger target, because having been in this business a long time, whenever a celebrity or someone from the entertainment business comes, people are ready. They want to take you down. They want to go. And one of the things that I've seen that's been really impressive is there used to be more shit coming out back in the day where they just slapped their name on it. But now I'm noticing that I think people from the entertainment world have realized you have to bring it. And if you don't, you're going to be done immediately, because a lot of the stuff that's coming out, and I would certainly put Artingstall's up there, right up there, It's really good. It's high quality. And you talked about it earlier. A big part of that is finding the right partner, finding somebody who, you know, I can write a screenplay. I can't direct it. I might not be able, but I can find the right partner for it. You find the right talent. You find the right actor. And that's such an important thing. And it sounds like you're very happy with the distillery partner that you found here.
I mean, they are the best, absolutely the best, you know, and I'm not even like blowing smoke in a showbiz way. I mean, it's such a finicky partnership. And that was why my agency was like, look, they're not going to do it. Because most of these big liquor companies, it's just like, you know, either they want a name that they can just go, we're going to sell that name and just we're going to do what we want to do. Like, they don't want you involved, you know, that involved in the minutia of this. But the fact that the size of this company and the hands-on quality of this company, you know, from from moment one, we were a team. And, you know, I didn't know about the inside outside of, you know, the specifics of making booze, but I knew creatively and artistically and taste-wise what I wanted. And then Ravinder and Manjeet were able to walk me through the other stuff. And so I learned from them, you know, and it was just such a wonderful thing. But, you know, to your point about how, you know, how there was so much bad celebrity stuff for a while, bad product. They are students of that. I mean, I remember Ravinder and Manjeet walking me through various products that had failed and ones that had made it and what the properties were. You know, it usually came down to the fact of whether it was good or not. But then it was also how you present it, what you name it, what the bottle, you know, what the whole package of it is and what the story behind it is. You know, and that's why it was really important to me. The bottle was going to be as important as the gin. And because I wanted to make something that everybody wanted on their bar cart.
And it's a gorgeous, but I mean, this is a really beautiful, sturdy bottle here. Yeah, this is the kind of bottle that you keep when you're done with the gin. You keep it and you put maybe put some flowers in it or something, but it's a gorgeous bottle. And one of the other things I think, though, Paul, that you're doing, which I feel has been very instrumental in the brands that make it versus one that don't. And I'm talking about brands that are being run by either celebrities or director, you know, is you're going out and doing the work. And that wasn't always the case. I think the biggest crowd you got to win over first are the influencers of this industry who are the bartenders. At the end of the day, you can get all the press you want, but unless the bartenders believe in your product and are pushing your product, the ones making the cocktail lists and doing all that, you're kind of dead in the water, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's a level of respect that comes when they see that you're going out and you're going to Wine and Spirits Wholesalers Association. You're going out to events and you're pouring, you're bringing in, you're soliciting advice. You know, from the top bartenders and what kind of cocktail you think this would be in. You're doing that, and I think it's paying off. Now, I will ask you this, being a new brand, how has what we're going through now impacted your brand with COVID? And
well, it's been hard because I did a lot of what you're talking about, a lot of, you know, outreach where I was just going to all my favorite places, going to places I love, getting to know the bartenders, giving them samples, talking through it. And so I had all these places, restaurants and bars lined up that wanted to take it on, and then this happened. So before we could get anything into them, we got shut down. So it's been a bummer in that way. But at the same time, we were able to partner with like ShotsBox and, you know, The Flask and Duvan and these different places that have a mail order. So, you know, we're able to be sent to the 33 states that you can legally send booze to. So we are getting out there. But I'm, as we all are, frustrated by the fact that we can't get out and kind of do what we, you know, what we need to do. And I just wanted it to be out there more, you know, just because now's a great time to be able to enjoy a cocktail more so than when we're back to normal life. But, you know, the support for it has been great and people have been going. You know, we have ArdingStallsGin.com where it has all the different, you know, places you can mail order it from. But, you know, I just can't wait until we're out everywhere. And what I really can't wait for, too, is when we're out in the UK because I'm a big Anglophile and, you know, spent the last year living in London, you know, and it's such a town where they really respect and love gin. And Alessandro Palazzi, my hero, who's the
from
bartender.
Dukes. Yeah.
Yes. I had never had a more nerve-wracking 5 minutes than when I brought my gin to Alessandro for the first time. He's an old friend. We've known each other for 20 years to have him taste it because, you know, he does not pull punches. He will tell you if he hates it. And I remember he poured it and I was just like sweating and he took a taste, kind of, you know, licked his lips and kind of walked around and went away and came back. And I was like, oh my God, he's just trying to figure out how to tell me he hates it. And he's like, this is very good. This is very good. And he started going through all the properties of it. And I was like, oh, thank God. So now I just want to get in Duke's bar, you know, full time.
Duke's is a very, very famous spot in London. And in fact, we just had Phil Rosenthal was on the show recently. And Phil had shot something over there and he went in there and he was talking about, I think I saw something in your press as well, where that is the pinnacle. That's and everything he does is frozen, right? That's how it's been a few years since I've been to Duke's, but everything in the martini just comes, he freezes everything. right?
Yeah, everything's frozen. He freezes the glass, freezes the gin or vodka if he makes it that way. And so it never touches ice. So, you know, but they're 4 ounce martinis, which is the most sensible martini. Let's can we put a moratorium on the 10 ounce martini, please? I beg the world.
Although I have to admit, I've been having a few of those during quarantine.
Oh,
because nobody's keeping score. Yeah. Like, you know what? I'm 6 ounces. Let's go 8 ounces. Let's take it to 10.
I just hate when I go out to dinner and I order a martini and they bring me a 10 ounce martini because like, oh man. So I'm just like kind of screwed for the rest of the evening.
Yeah.
But you know, it also gets warm too fast unless you really chug it. But Alessandra's thing is because that is completely undiluted. You're only allowed to have two because, they'll just knock you out of your butter.
Knock you down. One more question for you, Paul. Obviously the Hollywood stuff's been put on hold. I read that you were working on a pilot when this all went down. What's next for you? Or do you just not have any idea right now?
No, I mean, I've got a stack up of projects. I mean, I produced the shows Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist and Love Life, and we just both those got picked up for a season two.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So going into writing on that. Yeah, the show we were shooting, we still need to finish, but I was able to shoot enough stuff that we could cobble together this 16-minute presentation. It's a BBC, it's a remake of a BBC show called This Country. Super funny. Fake documentary. And then I'm just in prep now to do a big movie for Netflix called The School of Good and Evil. So, so we're in heavy prep, but all on Zoom and all this and just kind of going like, well, someday we'll be able to get back on a set and make something.
That's
great. We don't know when.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. Am I saying it right? My Philly's coming up. Artingstalls.
Artingstalls, yeah.
And that Artingstall is your mother's maiden name.
That was her maiden name.
Mother did not drink either, right?
No, my parents did not drink. They were Christian scientists, so I'm sure they're rolling in their graves right now. But I think my mom would actually love that she had a gin named after her. But I wanted it to sound like something that had been around for 150 years.
And it does, and it's got that look. Now, where can people find it, Paul?
Well, right now, again, in Canada, it's the LCBO. It's in all, other than in BC, it's in all the liquor stores, the state-run liquor stores in Canada. So you can get it everywhere in Canada. But in the States, go to artingstallsgin.com, and you can get the mail order, like I said, through ShotsBox, through the Flask, through Remedy Liquors, and through Duvan. And they can if you can have booze sent to your state, we can send it to you.
Get it. Okay. And any on social media, anybody follow you anywhere?
On Instagram, it's Artingstalls Gin, at Artingstalls Gin.
And I'll be posting something at the Imbiber, a little video clip from this interview here with Paul. Paul Feig, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Dan.
And we'll be right back after this message from our sponsor. Hey, all. Being on lockdown these past few months has been tough on all of us. Something I've found to be extremely helpful in maintaining my sanity during this challenging time is sticking to daily routines. Maintaining a sense of structure can help prevent you from feeling overwhelmed, and I highly recommend you keep doing the little things you used to do on the regular in the pre-COVID era, like shaving, for instance. And fortunately, Harry's is here to help you look your best while saving you a little cash along the way. Yes, Harry's has your grooming needs covered with high-quality blades as low as $2 each, delivered straight to your doorstep. Cut out the middleman, manufacturing blades in a German factory that's been honing the craft for a century, which means you get incredibly high-quality blades at factory direct prices. And during this trying time, you'll feel a little better about your purchase. Not only is Harry's donating 1% of proceeds to nonprofit organizations devoted to helping provide access to better health care for men and veterans, they're also giving $1 million worth of shaving supplies to hospitals across the U.S. That's what I call good karma for you and Harry's. What We're Drinking listeners can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/drinking. That's harrys.com/drinking. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, a 5-blade razor with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. So go to harrys.com/drinking to start shaving better today.
Hey everybody, this is Ed Kowalczyk from the band Live, and you're listening right now to the second best voice from Pennsylvania.
I guess that's me. Thanks, Ed. Appreciate it. The U.S. Bartenders Guild is a group that, as the name suggests, it's a union of bartenders around the country. and the USBG as a national charity foundation. And this week they released their recommendations to maximize safety when reopening bars and restaurants, which has kind of slowed down, I guess, right now. But it's going to happen. It is happening in some places more quickly than others. So just give you a couple ideas of some of the things that they put on here. Again, these are recommendations for the bars. Some of them are pretty obvious. No shoes, no shirt, no mask, no service. This isn't about denying civil liberties. It's about protecting a worker population that in large part does not have the benefit of employer-provided health insurance. Remember that when you go. Those of you who are griping about your liberties being taken away, you might be given this disease, you might be giving this virus to people who don't have access to healthcare, and that could be devastating. It could be fatal as well. By the way, I give up on this episode. The neighbor's dog is going crazy. There's airplanes flying over. I kept pausing to try to let these noises go, but I don't even give a shit anymore. Bark, dog, fly planes. Okay, where were we? Signs everywhere. They're recommending signs. Perhaps as important as your reopening safety measures are signs that communicate them to the guests. Certain areas ease up on state-mandated measures. Some guests are going to attempt to challenge these measures. We've already seen that. We've seen a lot of videos about it. So they need the rules need to be posted in all these places. You got to communicate at the entrance that masks are required, tell them to wash their hands when they come out of the restroom, all this stuff, okay? The physical distancing, PPE for the employees, physical barriers. You're starting to see that a lot. Actual physical barriers between the staff and guests. That's going to be the new normal for a while. Taking it outside is highly recommended. Here in Los Angeles, they have shut down bars today, actually. Inside, can't go inside. You got to have an outdoor area now. And I think that's going to be the case for a long time. Limiting group size, we're seeing that. The menus got to be one-time use paper menus. Multiple people can't be handling these things. It's got to be hand sanitizer everywhere. Strength in numbers. You got to present a unified message that communicates to guests that you are committed to their safety and they can be trusted with their well-being. Post to social media, you know, the no shoes, no shirt, no mask, no service. Tag other establishments that you're friendly with that are part of your group. And you got to be prepared. That's the key thing. Many bars and restaurants that are open for regular service are experiencing much higher than normal demand for food and drink. So you got to be ready for that. If you're out there, you own a bar, you own a restaurant, be ready. If you want to get updates from the USBG National Charity Foundation, you can follow them at USBGNCF on Twitter. And I think that's on Instagram as well. And they do an Instagram live on Thursday, July 2nd at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern time. I think that's going to do it for this episode of the show. I want to thank you for spending time here with me. I like it. I like doing this. It's fun. It's keeping me going. I want to thank Paul Feig. Check out his gin. It's delicious. I mean it. Follow me at The Imbiber on Twitter and Instagram. I welcome your comments and questions and anything else. We'll be back next week. Yeah, we will. I promise.